I know the next words I'm going to say are going to sound kind of frighteningly dour for what is basically a standard issue baseball story, but I never forget that this podcast has an emotional, psychological component to it. And so I have to ask, did you have supportive parents? I did and I didn't. I had one parent who was relentlessly supportive but was kind of absent. And I had another one who was also relentlessly supportive but usually in the way of negative feedback, meaning that they said, if you don't buckle down in school, you'll grow up to be a busboy or a dishwasher. And this had a way of undermining my confidence because it wasn't expressed quite so calmly. Anyway, for those of you younger than I am, one thing I've learned in my life, having become a parent myself, is that they don't give you a book. Well, there are books, but I don't know how much help they really are. And the truth is that you don't know that much more about being a parent the moment after your first child is born than you did the moment before, and you do the best you can because, unfortunately, whether you're a parent or not, you're still the same flawed, screwed-up bastard you always were, and if you're not a jerk, you just try to adhere to the rule of being loving and doing no harm, and you hope that it works out for the best. So I'm not telling you that because I still fault these people who raised me. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. That was their story. Their story intersected with my story. It doesn't always work out the way that you plan it. I was thinking about this in the context of all things of free agency. Prior to Thursday's Brewers' sudden Batman strike on the free agent and trade market, picking up Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich, it had been, as you well know, deathly quiet throughout the hot stove season. I've seen where other people have called it the cold stove season, and that seemed, again, until Thursday, very appropriate. But one reason that has been offered for it being quiet, and again, it's so quiet that I saw a headline on my pal Craig Calcaterra's site today that some of the remaining free agents are thinking of having their own homestead camp. And you'll recall the homestead camp was where they put all the unsigned players when the strike shook out in 1995. Cain and Yelich aside, it's still kind of a problem. As I was saying, one reason that people have asserted for the winter being so slow is that teams have finally understood that long-term free agent contracts are a bad deal, that the original team got the player from 22 to 26 or 27 or what have you, and the team that signs him for 5 or 6 years may still get a few good ones out of him, but you're going to get burned on the tail end of the deal. And of course, if you go longer than that, say the long deals that the Yankees gave CC Sabathia, who certainly wasn't the same guy at the end that he was at the beginning, or Alex Rodriguez, ditto, or the deal that the Angels are living with Albert Pujols now, it's just not smart. What I find fascinating about this is that generationally, knowledge comes and goes. It's kind of like the Vietnam thing, right? The leadership of our country for a long time was kind of reluctant to do anything militarily because of the lessons of the Vietnam War, which is that if you don't go all in, you may not win. Subsequently, we forgot that, and as a result, we got bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq. Similarly, teams learned right off the bat that these huge, long free agent deals were a bad idea. And kind of the standard bearer for that was a pitcher named Wayne Garland, and he's not well remembered today. He was never an all-star. He never won a Cy Young Award. But what he happened to do was that he had his breakout season in 1976. He went 20-7 with a 2.67 ERA for the Baltimore Orioles that year, just as free agency and his free agency was coming in. So he looked like one of the more attractive items on the market. He wasn't necessarily. Today, we would say he was a control guy with a below-average strikeout rate. Not hugely below average, but below average. About 7-8% below average. He had thrown 14 complete games that year. And most notably, in his last start of the season, when he was going for his 20th win, Earl Weaver really wanted to get him that 20. And so he left him in for all of an 11-inning game, and he threw 155 pitches. That was his last appearance as an Oriole. He made $26,000 that year, and that offseason, the Indians, of all teams, a team that was perennially scuffling at that time, was talking often about moving out of Cleveland because Cleveland was so dead. It was part of the Rust Belt, and there had been so much flight to the suburbs, and there was just not a basis to support a team there, and they couldn't get a good one going if they tried anyway. They threw what was then the lavish sum of $2.3 million over 10 years at Garland. And as he has often pointed out since, nobody would turn that down, and he didn't. The upshot of the deal was typically Cleveland for that period. Warming up for his very first spring training appearance, Garland shredded his rotator cuff. Incredibly enough, he pitched through it. He pitched 282.2 innings. His managers were Frank Robinson and Jeff Torborg that year, just for the record. And it wasn't good. It wasn't terrible either. His ERA was 3.60 in a 4.06 league. So he did pretty well, but that was like the last full measure of devotion that his arm could give. And the next year, he had surgery, and he was just done. He kept trying to come back for a good part of his contract, but if you combine his sporadic work both in the rotation and the bullpen, over the next 4 years, both starting and relieving, the Indians put him in the bullpen to take some pressure off of that arm. His ERA was 5.28, and 5.28 was a lot worse then than it is now. They finally released him in 1982. He tried to come back in the Yankee system of all places. That didn't work out either. And he was done at 30, and he still had half a decade left to run on that contract. His wasn't the only poorly judged contract at that time. A winter later, Richie Zisk got 10 years and $2.5 million from the Rangers. And Richie Zisk was a very good hitter, but he also didn't last till 1987. He was done as of 1983, and the Rangers had to trade him out of town because their financial circumstances changed and they couldn't afford to carry a DH at that price. And so those kinds of deals went away for a while, and shorter duration contracts became the norm until recently, when teams forgot, and now they've remembered. And all these flawed free agents, with the exception of Lorenzo Cain, are just sitting there because they're not going to get the years, and they shouldn't get the years. And there may yet be collusion, there may yet be other factors influencing this market, but the fact is, you really don't want to sign Mike Moustakas for 5 years. There's just no reason to do it. And so we're at an impasse between expectations created on one side and the understanding of the value of the deals on the other. And certainly, no one wants to hear that they don't deserve 10 years, or 5 for that matter, or 3. That's a hell of a blow to one's ego. Which brings me back to Wayne Garland. When Garland signed his contract as one of the first big money free agents in baseball history, he told his mom, "Hey, Mom, I just got $2 million from the Cleveland Indians." And you know what his mom said? "You're not worth it." I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Steel Cockatoo, who is the Lord of Castle Vindictive, says that if you wish me to free Princess Glamora, you must undertake 3 quests. First, you must find a dragon, teach him to read Faulkner, and like it. Second, you must battle the Council of Dark Wizards until they concede that the carbon dioxide output from their spellcasting is having a real and deleterious effect on the environment. Finally, you must climb Mount Murky, ford the Falls of Blood, cross the Pit of Itches, which appear in unreachably private places, and return with the Mystic Sword of Trimorgan, which is actually a tiny thing made of plastic such as you sometimes see stuck into cocktail wieners. And you think, Princess Glamora is hot, but I could have stayed home and listened to episode 39. As for the Mystic Sword of Trimorgan, you could put somebody's eye out with that thing. Welcome back to the show. Today I'm rejoined by David Roth. The holidays, which seem like a while ago now, really wreaked havoc with our starting rotation here. My initial plan when I started this podcast was to have Cliff, Jesse, and David show up roughly once a month each, with the fourth week given to some wildcard guest. As things have worked themselves out, I have spaced out their appearances a little bit more, but when you add in some of the guests we've had and then the two holiday weeks in which there were no guests at all since I did shortened shows, again, I must always say short by the standards of this very lengthy podcast, it really blew things apart, so that this is David's first appearance since November. It was utterly unintentional, just kind of happened that way. What ensues is, I hope, a conversation you will find as neat as I did. It's really fascinating in that we pulled the camera way back, and no matter how much I tried to analogize the current baseball situation to the current political situation and vice versa, it kept coming back to baseball. And I don't mean that as a criticism, it was right. Because, and this is a cliche to say that baseball is a microcosm of our society, but it's a cliche because it's true. And right now, you have a certain indolence in baseball, again, I must say the Brewers aside, that hadn't happened yet when we talked, that is reflected in the culture at large. And it's something about not delivering a quality experience in return for what we put into it, whether that's our fan money, our attention going to the team, whether in time spent watching a television broadcast or appearing at the ball games ourselves, and ditto our tax dollars or our votes or our protests or any form of interaction that you might have. Because, and it seems that there's this understanding in so many places that, yeah, you're going to get a bad return on your investment, whatever you do, but you're going to like it because you have no choice. In this whole experience, this whole interaction, you are impotent. The Lords of the Hall of Fame want Jack Morris and not Barry Bonds. Well, they're going to send out a letter from Joe Morgan saying don't vote for Barry Bonds, and they're going to put Jack Morris in even though he had 15 tries through other means. You a Braves fan? They're moving. You're paying for it, whether you wanted them to move, whether you wanted to pay for it. You a fan of the Orioles, Marlins, Reds, Pirates, A's? Well, they're not serious. You'll come to the games anyway. And on the way to the ballpark, you'll stop off at Applebee's with the whole family for their new special Gristle Bunk, a hot new combination of deep-fried chicken fat, garnished with sriracha, and served with unlimited helpings of fries that have been doused in Campbell's beef stew. In as much as the economy has recovered since the big crash in 2008-2009, and employment has recovered, and wages have ticked up somewhat, people still don't feel a whole lot better about the way things are going. Discontent breeds discontent. And again, there's just this expectation that you're going to live with it, and maybe because of peak TV we do, I don't know. Early in the show, I made a comment to David that the Reds still have roughly the same starting rotation that they ended the year on, and that starting rotation had an ERA of about 5.55, as bad as any team in baseball, if not worse. And they're not doing anything to change that. And that's typical of all too many clubs. I mean, when you have a glaring weakness, address it. But no, we don't address it. And I don't care what your political philosophy is, whether you're on the right or the left, there are things that need work. Systemic things that aren't just a question of pulling yourself up and bootstrapping yourself and so on. You need the physical and economic might of the whole society to lick the problem, and that's what a government is. There are many aspects of our lives that have a 5.55 ERA. Let's just say bridges and roads and infrastructure. Again, whatever your political persuasion is, it doesn't matter if you are left or right or what your economic philosophy is. You don't want to be the person in your Volvo on that bridge over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis on August 1st, 2007, where you end up dead in the drink because the bridge just goes as you're crossing it. And I would like to argue here that going back to the origins of governments, we can go back to the Roman Empire, that, again, I keep repeating this, whatever your political philosophy is, because there's so much posturing about this stuff, but I think we all have a basic expectation that the role of government, never mind what it's going to do about controversial things that we argue about, like abortion or various immigrant groups, we have the right to expect that there will be a basic functionality in the society such that if you go out to the store for groceries, you can get home without getting killed. And similarly, you have a right to expect that if you patronize the Cincinnati Reds or the New York Mets, I should have mentioned them to this point, you have a right to believe that whereas they will not always win, that they are making a game effort at doing so. And of course, that's not true. And I want to take the few minutes we have remaining here before I roll David out onto the stage to talk about that contrast between the Mets and the Brewers. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll see that I did a little of this already. But when a small market team like the Brewers, a team whose daddy, Bud Selig, designed the revenue sharing system to gently cradle, such that they never need worry whether they were serious or not, is making a game effort to win something by picking up Christian Yelich, trading off some of the many prospects they've compiled over the last few years, and signing Lorenzo Cain, who, again, I've discussed this in other episodes of the show, I discuss it in this show, is kind of one of those free agents that makes you nervous for the Wayne Garland reasons I talked about at the beginning of the show, but still, they're making the effort, and when Brandon Nimmo is your alternative, nothing against Brandon Nimmo, I like his plate judgment, but you're a big market team. You can afford, in theory, to sustain a Wayne Garland risk, a Lorenzo Cain risk. If he gets old and injured, okay. You certainly have experience if you're the Mets with old and injured. I was thinking about extinction in baseball. I was thinking about Connie Mack and the Philadelphia A's. You know, if you could go back in time to the 1930s, the early 1930s, and tell the average Philadelphia baseball fan that one day their town would have only one team, I guess they'd believe you. If you told them that the one team was going to be the Phillies, they might laugh in your face because the Phillies didn't draw and the Phillies didn't win and the Phillies lost 90 to 100 games every year, whereas up through 1931 or even 1932, they won 90-something games that year. The A's had won a whole bunch of World Series, a whole bunch of pennants. They had great players from Home Run Baker to Jimmy Fox over the years. And yeah, they had their down periods when Connie Mack would break the club down for whatever reasons and lose dreadfully for a long time. But on the whole, that was the team. But right after World War II, their attendances crossed. And they were sharing the same ballpark at that point. So it's not like the Phillies had a better location. They had the same location. And they weren't a whole lot better at that time. In fact, the 47, 48, 49 A's were surprisingly good given the overwhelming run of 90 to 100 game losers that the A's were putting up in that period. As the Phillies built up to their 1950 World Series appearance, they stole the hearts of that town. The amazing thing is they weren't a whole lot more progressive. They did a whole lot better with the farm system, whereas the A's were owned and managed by a man who was literally senile, who was on the bench calling for Stuffy McGinnis to get into the game, even though Stuffy McGinnis hadn't been on the team for 35 years. They did not believe in the farm. They did not integrate. They did not invest in the team. And so, whereas they were once the number one team in a two-team town, they became, even as they were winning a little, they became irrelevant. People just didn't believe in them anymore. And eventually, as Mac aged into his 90s, as his sons, he had two different marriages, two different sets of offspring, and he divided the team among them, which wasn't the most brilliant thing to do, because from Charlemagne onward, we know where that goes. Watch The Lion in Winter sometime. It's a movie about King Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine and all that stuff, but it's also about Connie Mack trying to divide his baseball team between three kids. And squabbling leads to paralysis. Paralysis leads to the kingdom being divided. The kingdom being divided leads to the team being sold and moved to Kansas City. In a fair world, in a world in which there wasn't so much special pleading and breaks given to those who rule over us in baseball and in other ways, the laws of Darwinistic survival would apply, as they applied to Connie Mack. They had that team, in whole or in part, for approximately 55 years. But it turned really fast. They were gone. In the 20s, the A's were drawing 800,000 to 850,000 people a year. The Phillies over at the Baker Bowl were drawing 250. The Phillies finished eighth of eighth in the National League in attendance over and over and over again, including every single year from 1932 to 1942. But within 5 years of that point, they had won the city, and they hadn't won anything at all yet, hadn't been to the postseason since 1915. Conversely, in 1950, the Phillies won 91 games in the NL pennant, and they drew 1.2 million. The A's lost 100 games and drew about 310,000, and that was all she wrote. What happened to the Mets should happen in New York, too. Should happen to a lot of these teams. But it seems to me that the team in the big market should be the first to experience the consequences. And by that, I don't mean that the Mets are going to be moving out of Queens anytime. I don't think that baseball would be so stupid as to leave a metropolitan area of 10 million people with only one team again. As it is, it should have three again. It shouldn't have two. It should maybe have four. There's a lot of money here and a lot of population. But be that as it may, I think there will always be a Mets. But there won't always be a Wilpons. Because here's the thing, and this goes for both team owners and politicians. Parasites can last a long time. They can prosper tremendously. But once they have ruined the host, to the point that the host is no longer a viable entity, the host dies. And at that point, the parasite has destroyed itself. In any field of endeavor, when you stop delivering quality to your patrons but expect them to give you their money anyway, what should we call you but a parasite? When something shouldn't continue, chances are it won't, and in all of human history, that equation has been unsustainable. It just requires time, time requires patience, and that's hard. Still, for right now, the thought that someday even the stupid must pass seems like an optimistic concept. We'll pause for a word from our sponsors. Although I hear from some that sometimes the word from the sponsor doesn't appear, you just get a gap. Well, we'll either pause for a word from our sponsors or you'll just get a relaxing 5 seconds of silence. In either case, we'll pause, and then I'll be right back with David Roth. It's been far too long since we talked to my next conversational partner. He's the Theodore Roosevelt to my Miss Piggy, the Kermit the Frog to my William Howard Taft. He's David Roth, editor and columnist at Deadspin. How are you, David?
I'm good, man. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk again, except that as long as it's been, things are in kind of stasis, aren't they? It's January 2018. Donald Trump is still president, and the Cincinnati Reds still have the same starting rotation that they had last October. And that starting rotation had a 5.55 ERA, so that's like not a positive thing. It's not like renewing Lefty Grove and guys like that. We're stuck, and I don't know what to do about it. Help me out here, David.
Yeah, I would love to be able to do that. I'm not fully sure that I can. The idea that both of those things are on a similar order of inexplicable is heartening to me. I mean, just if our biggest problem was that like Jumbo Diaz was getting too many innings out of the pen or something, that would be a world I'd want to live in. But yeah, it's weird. I've wrote about that this week, just a bit that went up today, and it's hard. I was talking to our mutual buddy Mark Normandin about this in another window earlier, that it seems very much like there's some element of collusion to how cold the hot stove has been this offseason, but also it just kind of feels like it's hard to tell. Like it might just be that these guys don't give a shit and aren't trying to show fans that they're building a competing team, or they're trying to, you know, do something to reset the luxury tax. But at some point, the line between the two is very difficult to see.
As you pointed out in the piece that you're referring to, teams are doubly subsidized this year. They not only have revenue sharing, which is a nice hammock for them in any season, but they're also picking up something like $50 million a pop for the sale of BAM to, I believe, the Disney people.
Yes.
So this is like everybody's landed on free parking. And, you know, what the heck, 2018, you know, write it off. We're going to make money even if we, you know, we'll field a lineup of nine mascots and the Philly Fanatic will back clean up. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's the part of it that I really have a hard time with. I mean, and again, you know, you don't want to keep going back to Trump, at least not this early in the podcast. But the idea of, you know, just the insult that is implied in that, the idea of every single one of these consecutive inactions being predicated on the idea that, like, whatever, you people will watch or take anything, or like you won't notice or you won't care or whatever. Like, it's hard not to take that sort of shit personally. The idea that, like, the Wilpons throw, you know, that they sort of try to rebuild a 70-win Mets team and then are like, well, there you go. Like, we're committed to winning. Like, that may be, they're a different case because they're such oafs that it might be that actually is true, that they, like, are only going to sign guys that have been with the Mets before because, like, Fred thinks that you have to show that you can play in New York or whatever. And it's just a complete circle of poo. But I honestly, like, a lot of this stuff, like the inaction on the part of Jeff Passan identified maybe 10 teams that are effectively sitting out the offseason. Like, that's baffling. And, like, it's a league-wide problem. It's not the same. You get one Tampa Bay Rays and you have a problem. If you have 9 of them, then you have, like, a much bigger problem.
You wrote in the piece, I always find myself, because I enjoy your writing so much, quoting it back to you. And I know you just cautioned me not to extrapolate to the overall situation, at least.
Oh God, both going to do it, man. Don't even feel guilty about it.
Well, okay, so I'm going to paraphrase. I'm going to read more or less what you wrote, but I'm going to replace a few choice words because I have to admit my brain was doing it automatically as I read this, because I think I'm going to say that this was malice aforethought on your part, that this column was meant to operate on two levels. So that the main part of this column was, as
I would never.
I am shocked that you have discovered subtext. This column was about the fact that we're having a notoriously slow baseball winter, that some people have thrown around the C word collusion. There are other reasons, which is that the free agent class is extremely weak and on a lot of levels, and even the good guys have a lot of negatives to them, at least negatives that would pronounce themselves very strongly if you sign them for 3 to 5 years and a lot of money on a one-year basis. That a lot of them are great, but you're not going to get them on a one-year basis.
Yeah.
So you were, I believe this paragraph graduated from a discussion of what the Derek Jeters of the world are doing and all these teams that are tearing down and taking it off, and that we have to accept that, yes, they mean it benevolently, that this is not just profiteering. It's a Houston Astros style teardown that will lead to the promised land in the coming year. So again, I'm going to lightly paraphrase this and tell me if this still works. From a citizen's perspective, believing in this approach or even accepting its validity means trusting that the people doing it are in earnest and acting in good faith. Yes, it looks like they're stripping the country's assets and stubbornly refusing to cut into their own profits to improve what they own. It looks very much like they are taking a country that or a job that could be seen as a public good held in a public trust and treating it as if it were a Walmart, cutting every possible corner as much as possible in hopes of arriving at something that is just shitty enough to be acceptable. A politician, a statesman, an owner, that's the word you used, who does this, or a league that allows it, or a country that allows it, is in some sense asking for your trust. But in a more urgent sense, it is betting that it doesn't really matter very much to you, or that you'll take the insult with good cheer. And I was thinking not only of this, but of a sketch in relationship to this that was on Saturday Night Live this week, in which they had a quiz show asking what matters, and they rolled off a series of things like sex and hush money with a porn star, or calling third world countries shitholes. Do they matter? Will the people who did them, in this case the same person, be called to account? The answer was always no. And I felt like just maybe you were driving at the same point.
Yeah. You know, when you hear it read out loud like that, it kind of does seem like I was making a broader point. This was the first thing I'd written in a couple of weeks, and it had been really sort of eating at me, and it wound up coming out a little bit tangier than I expected it to. But it is, yeah, I mean, obviously that is what I'm sort of saying there. I mean, that's the part of it. There's two ways in which I think of this as being broadly connected to our current situation. And one of them is the one that you, I think, very ably summed up there by substituting a few different words, which is just basically the idea that people are betting that they can get away with anything. And then I guess the other one sort of is the idea that, you know, making that bet comes with a certain belief in your own impunity, or just a faith that you'll be able to get away with whatever it is that you want. And that, to me, like, that, I don't know that, you know, there was never like a golden era of rich shitheads in the United States. I mean, that, like, you go back 100 years and people are just as bad. Like, money makes people weird. Privilege makes people cruel. And it has, you know, kind of ever been thus. But I think the thing with this era that's different, and the part of it that I think, you know, for all the more urgent threats to, you know, to dreamers, to, you know, minorities, to any citizen in the country, I think one of the things about Trump that I felt more is just this idea that because he doesn't even try to act in a way that, you know, is honest or forthright or fair, it just seems like everybody else feels, you know, that has power feels like they can do that too. And not everybody can sell it quite as well as him, but for sure, nobody's even trying to put like a, you know, a veneer on this stuff anymore. And it's hard to complain about the loss of a veneer because that's all it ever really was. It just has this feeling increasingly that this was maybe a load-bearing veneer and that without it, that things are Hobbesian and and really disturbing in that way. Not like cool in a Hobbesian way, like the Purge or the Royals.
Well, I think one of the things that's troubling about that, as you point out, that there's kind of a sleight of hand at work here, that you're not supposed to realize that the people in charge of these teams don't really care about making an effort. They still want you to come in and buy hot dogs and foam fingers and stuff and root for the team, whether they have a chance or not. But they want you to also believe, and they've successfully convinced many fans, again, hey, look, the Astros did it, and look how well it worked out for them. So baseball under Bud Selig made it, as what he was for most of his reign, owner of the Milwaukee Brewers, this sure as hell seems like special pleading on his case, made it possible to have a non-competitive team year in, year out, and you can still make your profits and tell people, no, we're really trying. We are efforting here. And what disturbs me about that is that people will buy that, and they will even say, and have said about even recently, as recently as a couple of years ago, before last year's renaissance, even the Yankees, like, tear it down, crash it to the bottom, lose 100 games, reap the draft choices, rebuild. And of course, it's much easier to tear something down to build it up than build it up. And there's no guarantee that the buildup will happen. So they do get fooled on this baseball level, and then we expect them to not be fooled on kind of the macro level, the whole culture level, or as we were just talking about, the political governmental level. And it's just like a whole aspect of critical thinking is just right out the window.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it too goes with what side of it you see yourself as being on. I think most political thought comes from this idea where you start with yourself, which is natural in terms of who benefits from this and how does it benefit me? And the idea of, like, you know, I think so much of the idea that Trump has gotten away with in terms of painting immigrants and poor people as somehow getting over on everyone else is that, you know, it's an easy way to get people to sort of be on your side, because ordinarily they're going to, you know, they're looking for someone to blame for the fact that they don't have enough and that they're uneasy and that they're still unhappy. And so the business of it becomes finding somebody else to blame. Anyway, what I'm saying is I don't think Trump is very good. I actually think he's quite bad.
At the lie, you mean?
No, just in general. No, I think he's as a salesman, I don't think he's great either, but it seems like the sort of thing where people are buying it. I guess that what I wanted to sort of say about that, and I'm confusing myself here. If you see yourself as being on the side that is being taken advantage of by other people, you're going to naturally align yourself tribally with other people that you see as being on that side and against that other group of people. As fans, the idea of, like, what side of this are you on? There are two sides of it. There's owners, there's management, and then there's players, which is labor. And I think players are the ones that do things that we think are cool. You know, like, it would be nice to have money, but it would be cooler to be able to do what Clayton Kershaw does. You know, like, and
absolutely
money for that too. It's a great deal. Like, he's got things pretty well worked out for himself. And I salute a longtime listener to the podcast, Clayton Kershaw, on having done a fantastic job there. But in this case, I think something, you don't want to say it's all Moneyball, because this has been the case for, you know, every time there's been labor unrest in baseball. The idea that people are now maybe more into the fantasy of doing more with less, tearing it down and building it back up, these are all, that's management. That's like organizational heroism as opposed to athletic heroism. And, you know, it might be that that relates more to the average person's day-to-day life, which is like, has more to do with like being in a cubicle than it does like doing box jumps at the spring training facility all winter. But the idea that that sort of could wind up being like corrosive to like a basic solidarity with the idea that like these players who do these things should be fairly compensated, that like the teams should be trying to give us like a product that, you know, is worth our money. Like, you know, when you lose sight of that stuff, then at that point, it's just a question of like how much the owners want to get away with. Right.
Right. And again, that's a problem because there's a lot of information that goes with that, that we have to take on faith. Right. So if the owner of any team, right, that we, it could, you know, and it could be an imaginary team, the Newark Diamonds, the American League East Newark Diamonds, he says that he's subsidized the team to a great deal of money out of his own pocket, and revenues just aren't what they were, and so they've got to retrench. Attendance was down a little bit last year. You're not seeing his books. You don't see what it is that he's actually making and not making, how the revenue sharing affects his bottom line, how the TV deals affect his bottom line, and so forth. You just have to take his word for that. And I've seen that. I really didn't need a hypothetical example, because all you really need to do is listen to a call-in show. Rarely a good idea, but you can do it. Or read the comment sections on anything, including, in fact, the column that you wrote on Deadspin, where people were complaining about this same effect, that people will say, jump up and take Bob Nutting's side in terms of what the Pirates are doing to reduce their payroll, because they'll say, well, you know, it's a low revenue team and he means well. Yeah. You don't know that. You don't know that at all.
If he doesn't have the money to run a baseball team, then you shouldn't own it. There's enough rich people out there in the fucking world. Like, for better or worse, there's like a bunch of guys that could, in Western Pennsylvania, there's guys that could afford to do that. You know, right. I mean, this is like, and wind up with, especially leagues with no salary cap. You look at the English Premier League. Those teams are owned by the rich assholes of every country in the world. It's not just they're not all Brits. The same guy that owns the Tampa Bay Buccaneers owns a team. Like, if you're rich enough, you can buy one. I don't like that necessarily, but if you're going to have an uncapped league and you're going to pay players a lot of money, then like the people that can afford to pay the players a lot of money should own the team. Like, that's basic. And if they're not willing to do it, then they shouldn't, you know, be owning a team. I think that idea, for me, the story of the offseason is letting the Jeter group buy the Marlins when they clearly did not have the funds to do it. And they don't have they can't operate a professional baseball team at the salary of a professional baseball team. So, like, I know he's a, you know, beloved tri-state area television personality, but, like, that's not enough to get Jeets and them over the line for me. Like, if you can't do it, then you shouldn't be allowed to do it.
Well, again, there's a lot there that we don't know. You know, one thing that we learned back when the Dodgers were going from being owned by the ownership, the husband and wife that owned it before the Magic Johnson group came in, was that
never has the term owned seemed more like accurate than that.
Oh, yeah, the same way that Pharaoh owned the Hebrews, I think for the same purposes. They had taken every aspect of the Dodgers and spun it off into its own company, and so the parking was its own company, and the food service was its own company, and the ballpark was its own company. So the team as a whole, even though it was responsible for creating all the revenues with all those associated companies, saw none of it. And not only that, but that created a separate executive suite for each of those entities, which, damn it, I've been meaning to do that in my own life, you know?
Right, I was going to say, we need to LLC ourselves into profitability.
Right, but like 20 times, right? So that we can collect a salary for the David Roth Beverage Company and the David Roth Writing Company and so on. And that, again, skims money right off the top, right? You're paying executive salaries for all these companies that are really just barnacles. They're leeches on the Dodgers in that case. I don't know that.
That's what I remember being so remarkable about that. And I feel like in some ways, even though it didn't happen very long ago, it's still like sort of understood what an unbelievable grift that was and how much the McCourts got away with it. Because by spinning all those things off, the thing that people were going to buy if they bought the Dodgers was not all the, you know, those things are what makes a team profitable. You know, that like all of those things add up to enough to defray the cost of paying Adrian Gonzalez too much money or whatever. Not anymore. The Mets are paying him now. When you take all those things out of the equation, the things that the McCourts were going to sell to a prospective buyer of the team, was the team was the only part that lost money. So this is like, again, like this is like a not a, a weird move in the world. This is like what, you know, real estate, it's how that operates or whatever, you know, that you, or like a leveraged sort of like purchase would be similar to this, but it's not honest, and it never should have been allowed to happen. And it does seem like right now that is the only example that we have of the, you know, commissioner's office being like, all right, that's too much.
And that only happened because of the divorce.
Right.
And because
because they were embarrassing.
Right, exactly. But how do we know that 29 other teams, or for that matter, the Dodgers still, are not copying that model? So when a Derek Jeter comes out and says, well, we've got to downsize this because we don't have the financial capacity. I mean, yeah, there are some things you can see if you look at any Marlins broadcast, like the stadium's half full or not even half full. Fine. I accept that. But there's so much more that we don't know about where the revenue is diverted to before it ever gets to Giancarlo Stanton and Marcell Ozuna and all those guys that they felt like they had to deal away.
Yeah. I mean, and that's part of it where, you know, it's one thing to take a politician or a, you know, team owner or whatever at their word. And it's a complicated thing to take those people at their word because they tend to fucking lie a lot. But it's also a difficult thing to, like, when you can't do anything but that, there's something very, I mean, whatever, you know, what else are you going to do? If you care about baseball and you live in South Florida, that's pretty much your option. It's just like, there's an insult baked into that that is very difficult to look past. And then once you see it, it becomes something that colors the experience of cheering for a team, which is otherwise the sort of thing that I think broadly would go on the positive side of any ledger of, you know, being alive. You wouldn't do it if you, no one's making you, you know, it's not like health insurance or something. But I mean, I don't know, like once you get to that point where like you sort of curdle that relationship with the fan base by making it explicit how the sort of relationship of command works or whatever, or like who's in charge of whom, then like once that's no longer like implicit but explicit, it's really hard to say like this is a team that is worth my time and my money, because it just seems like they're getting over on you and rubbing your nose in it too, you know?
Right, but that brings us back to the piece that you wrote and the fact that they are expecting you to lie down and take it and even enjoy it because you're not aware enough to call them on it. And this is what I mean about critical thinking going away, or the lack of transparency and information making us stupid, because fans will defend their right to do that as servicing some greater good, whether it's, I don't know, stopping the Pirates from moving to Las Vegas or the Marlins from, I don't know, going up in a puff of smoke altogether. They like act like it's a civic good, but you don't know. And it's one of the things that drives me nuts in this way. And
were there really people defending Bob Nutting in the comments of my fucking article?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I read the comments for you, David. So you do,
yeah, thank you.
You do owe me one there. I mean, no,
I had no idea that there were even people out there of that, like, Nutting heads, they call them.
Yeah, I don't know if they
right,
were.
I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I don't know if they were defending them so much as pointing out that such people who would defend him exist.
Okay.
But let me give Deadspin fans, readers, more credit than that. But they were invoking that in support of your argument. It was actually a very supportive comment group, David. I was surprised.
I appreciate
it. So, I mean, not that the work didn't deserve it, but I mean,
no, comment, saying, comment right. I was going to say supportive comment group is like the jumbo shrimp of online.
It's the unicorn. It's right. It doesn't really exist. But what I was going to say is that we don't have the right information, and we use the wrong analogies to understand these things. So in the same way that the Dodgers were not structured along the lines that your personal economy, you and your wife or me and my wife our structure our house economy, I should say, which is pretty much the David Copperfield idea, right? Which is if we take in $5 and we spend $4.50, the net result is happiness. And if we take in $5 and we spend $6, we're screwed. But baseball teams, big businesses don't operate like that. For one thing, they have access to billion-dollar lines of credit and so forth. And the same thing is true of governments, too. And when it comes to the shutdown that we were just experiencing this past weekend, again, I shouldn't do this. I'm reading comment sections. I'm listening to call-in shows. Yeah. This is my downward
too fast, spiral. Man.
Yeah, I think so. But people were giving all these standard boilerplate responses to that about how like our national debt is unsustainable and my daughter, who's only 6 years old, personally owes $35,000 for the rest of her. And it's like, no, doesn't work that way. And you don't know that the debt is unsustainable because as long as the rest of the world is willing to lend us money, we can just kite it on for as long as we want.
Like, that sounds like a hustle, but it's not. It's the way it has always worked.
Right. Exactly. Going back to Alexander Hamilton and for that matter in other countries before that, you actually want a national debt sometimes, and it can be a good thing, and it can be manipulated to all kinds of purposes, good and bad, but people don't get it. So then it comes down to, again, to bring it back to the baseball teams or the Mets or the Reds or the Marlins or whoever. They don't have the information to process this, and then they go out and buy their foam finger.
It's funny too, because like, I'm going to go to a bunch of Mets games next year, you know, like I don't want to act like I'm somehow like above or outside of this particular hustle. It's just a question of like how much you're willing to take, you know, like I won't sit here and be okay with them like stripping all of the assets from the team and trying to, and you know, refusing to pay any of their salary and getting like a bunch of like AAA relievers in hand. I can say that. And yet like they did that at the end of last year and I still went to games. I mean, I went because it was like $5 and it's a nice thing to do outside, but it's still like, I don't know, with any of this stuff, it's just a question of how much of a mark you're really willing to feel like. And I think that's a dark, it's not always that way. You know, I mean, I think that there's definitely teams where the relationship with the fans is healthier. Either they are more open about what it is they're trying to do and what they can do, or they actually are going for it because they're trying to, you know, go for it. Anytime that sports is like echoing the political scene or the broader world too clearly, like it's generally not in a good way. It's just, everything starts to feel kind of like everything else. And at that point, you are describing what it feels like to be depressed, basically. You know, like it's
right.
It's no good.
I mean, those of us who are aware, hopefully, I'm not trying to say that there's anything special about myself anyway. Present company maybe is very special. But you hope for rationality and you don't always get it. And I think we're in a particular age where you keep getting like slapped in the face that you don't get it. Whereas normally you might be able to kind of sublimate, that sense of things for a while and kind of get through your day.
Yeah, and you want to believe that people are being honest. I mean, this has been, I think, one of the more disillusioning things, again, beyond the actual practical things of these last sort of few years, is realizing that like people that you assume do not hold terrible beliefs or do not like that sort of recognize the validity of other people's lived experiences or whatever, you just assume that most people are like that, you know, and that it's weird when people are not. And that it seems like that maybe is assuming facts, not in evidence. And that's a disillusioning thing. I mean, I don't say I'm giving up on humanity or whatever. It's just sort of like depressing the amount of like abstraction that sort of creeps into things, even, you know, politically or just sort of broadly in the discourse, and like just what that does when you stop recognizing the humanity of all the people involved in all of this stuff. It really makes it so that you will be extremely easy to convince about almost anything.
Well, okay. So there's a hardcore 25-30% that believes in the present administration and the present president. And let's extrapolate and say that there's a hardcore 25-30% who really believes that the Marlins are treating them the right way. I mean, it should work, right? But even then, you'd think that you could puncture the gonfalon balloon of their belief by pointing out what you're saying is the next step after tearing it down and doing what the Astros did is that, like the Astros, they will head into the draft and pick up a Carlos Correa and an Alex Bregman and just nail it every time out. And frankly, even the Astros didn't nail it every time out.
No, I mean, they got it. And they also didn't, they started spending on actual major leaguers at the end, which is what put them over the top. you know, which is the other part of it that these teams never seem to quite get around to. Like the Pirates did everything right, you know, in they weren't trying to tank, but I mean, they nailed their picks. Like they had McCutcheon, they had Gerrit Cole, and like they had a window in which they really could have done stuff, and they just didn't really have it in them to spend the way that they could have to like put themselves over the top. And now they're taking it all apart and being like, yeah, well, we had our shot. And they didn't really shoot their shot.
I think that they're right that that particular window came and opened and closed very, very quickly.
Yes.
But you're right that they didn't do enough to wedge it open, which they could have. And I also think, I mean, sometimes you make bets that maybe seem like reasonable bets at the time and just turn out to be wrong. Like they probably said, you know, Starling Marte and Andrew McCutcheon and Gregory Polanco are the new all-star outfield of the next 10 years. And as it turned out, one guy was doing PEDs and didn't develop to quite that level. And Polanco, for all the physical talents, and he's still pretty young, but for all the physical talents that he showed, hasn't turned into that guy either. In fact, he's rode backwards pretty hard. And McCutcheon got old at a young age.
Yeah.
And so
the McCutcheon trade is one of those things where like it hurts and I feel bad and I haven't talked to a single fan of the team that feels good about it. But it's the sort of thing that teams sometimes do, right? If they think that he's declining, baseball's cruel that way, but it always has been. And, you know, that's the business part of it. The Cole one to me is objectionable because while he's not, you know, an absolute top drawer ace or whatever, he's also not being paid like an absolute top drawer ace. He's getting $7.5 million. Like, that's not on, you know, for the value that he delivers, that is an extremely good deal. And that's the sort of thing where when you make that trade, you're not just saying, it's not like with McCutcheon where it's like, well, we'd like to get something for him before his value disappears entirely. With Cole, it's like, well, we're not going to pay this guy $7.5 million, which to us is a lot and to the rest of baseball is not. Because, like, it doesn't really matter what's three extra wins.
The McCutcheon trade is defensible on a pure baseball standpoint, and the Cole trade is just sort of, you know, pulling the parachute and probably, saying we're out of here.
Yeah, there probably is a Cole trade that's defensible in baseball terms, you know, but this is the one that they made seems like not it. I mean, it seems like they were motivated sellers, as the saying goes. And for whatever reason, we're willing to take like I don't know enough about them. I'm going to like get into the nuts and bolts of the Astros farm system or whatever, but these are like kind of like marginal major league ready guys. That's not the trade that you make if you're stripping it down either. Like, you don't get a guy that's like a swingman and then like another, like a promising live armed relief pitcher that pitched in the bullpen for the actual major league club last year. Like, if you're going to go for it, like, get some guys that might actually be great, not guys where you kind of pretty much know what they are already.
They just got guys. And one of their problems has been with guys like Josh Harrison and Jordy Mercer and David Freese and so on, that they had guys who were just guys.
And they're good and good guys in the sense that they like plugged the holes between the stars in the lineup, which is like, you know, time-honored way of building a team, but yeah, not on their own. It makes a difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you got. Oh, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I. Steve here, unforgivably interrupting Ella Fitzgerald's great Duke Ellington songbook to invite you to enjoy this word from our sponsor, after which I'll be back with more conversation with David Roth. So I was just, as we were talking, trying to think that if it really was just $5 to go over to Citi Field, then it probably was cheaper than going over to the Shake Shack on 9th Avenue and getting your black and white over there. It was. I had the experience at the end of the year. I went to they had a rain delayed game that was being made up as a like late afternoon, evening doubleheader, twi-night, I guess was the term they used to use. And it was like the ticket for the rain delayed game was like, I think it was $7. And then like the beer that I got was like $8. And I feel like anytime you're paying less for the ticket than you are for the beer, first of all, the beer is too expensive. But second of all, that is an arbitrage opportunity that you should avail yourself of. Like, I just basically went there and like sat outside, drank two beers with a friend. I watched like Thomas Nido hit a double, and then I went home and like cooked dinner. Like, I didn't need, the games didn't mean anything to me. I just wanted to like see my buddies and sit outside for a little while.
And at that price, if it's not a compelling game, hell, you can check out and go home. You don't have
I left between games. That was what I did. So I got there to the first one a little bit late, stayed, watched the end of like a terrible blowout. I saw two guys that the Mets have already DFA'd give up home runs. Like, if it's like in the offseason with no transactions, somehow both of the Quad A relief guys that the Mets threw out there that day have already changed hands.
You know, I think I'm getting old in the sense that I used to purposely scour the schedule for Yankees or Mets doubleheaders. That's the area that I live in. It wasn't just that those were the two teams, but I loved up past college into my early adulthood, just like getting two games for the price of,
feels good.
Of one, going to the ballpark for like 9 hours. And a friend of mine had a tradition going up to Yankee Stadium that there was like a Roy Rogers or something on the turnpike or a Kentucky Fried Chicken. And he'd stop at the
I happen to know that it's a Roy Rogers. it's like that was what they used to have there. Go ahead.
Yeah. And well, he would buy a huge bucket of fried chicken and then kind of nurse it throughout these 9 hours, even though it would spend a good number of those hours sort of marinating in the South Bronx air under the seats at the old Yankee Stadium. I was very skeptical of that chicken after a certain point, but he's still with us. So I think he survived it. But there was a whole kind of positive sadomasochism to the experience that now it just sounds kind of exhausting to be there for quite that long.
Yeah, I definitely have had that. I mean, the times that I've had to cover games and you get there really early and stay there late and everything like that. And it's like, it's a very humbling sort of experience because I got into my later 30s secure in the belief that there was no such thing as spending too much time at a baseball game. And like, there is such a thing as spending too much time at a baseball game, and it sucks. And once you hit that limit, it's like, the idea of like a tolerable bus ride, and like the moment it starts to become an intolerable bus ride, you're like, oh my God, when am I ever going to get off this bus? And like,
and I want to explain to people who are listening, we sound like the most jaded jerk-offs ever because we have had a privilege that most fans would really like to have, which is to have a press credential and go into the clubhouses, talk to the players, sit in the press box and so on. But there is a huge, huge difference in the way that it goes when you're doing it professionally, because if you're sitting in the stands with friends or even watching the game at home, you can talk, you can cheer, you can entertain yourself in a lot of different ways during all those low spots that people who aren't really baseball fans complain about, like the commissioner who complains about them constantly. When you're in the press box, if you happen not to be sitting next to a pal of yours, and even if you are, that guy's working, you have to focus and in between innings be quiet. And it's a different, more aesthetic experience than it is going to the ballpark as a fan.
So the only time that I've covered meaningful baseball games was 2015 postseason, where I covered the Mets and the NLCS and the World Series. And it was, beyond being a more aesthetic experience, it was fucking excruciating. Because I had trained myself to believe that the Mets would never be in this position ever again. And I really did kind of think that, you know, until they got new ownership or unless a bunch of things really went right, that I would never be seeing them in the postseason. And then like a bunch of things went right. They were in the postseason. I was in like the auxiliary press box with like Radio Ecuador, as opposed to like, which is fine. They seriously were, there was Radio Ecuador was one row in front of me. There was like an Italian sports newspaper next to me. There was not the front row of like Bob Uecker coinage, but watching this team that I care about play these games, first in the NLCS where it's like anything is possible, and then in the World Series where it's like anything is possible, but for torture, like it was very hard not to respond. And it got to the point, by the time we got to the World Series, I was like, forget about it. Like, this might never happen again. And for an inning or so every game, I would go outside and I would buy one Bud Light and I would walk around the stadium for the time it took for me to finish a beer and like high five strangers as necessary and take notes. And then I'd go back up there. But it was like the idea of just watching an entire game and not yelling was not something that I think I would have had a very hard time with it.
Yeah, it's difficult. And really, the old tradition, no cheering in the press box, that's what you've got to do. And so I've allowed myself I mean, I've seen in the press box, I saw somebody hit into a triple play. I've seen, you know, great performances by some players who are now headed for the Hall of Fame. And all you can really allow yourself, and this is borderline, is to go, huh.
Yeah.
Like that's it. You can't be, I mean, they will throw you out. You are not allowed to cheer.
You did throw somebody out, but it was somebody that like randomly snuck in there who was cheering. I missed that part. But I know the person that held the door for the person that got checked out, kicked out, because it was like he was just being a gentleman. And then later on, I had to be like, oh boy, sorry, the yelling lady was in here. But yeah, I think the most I allowed myself when I was in there was an extremely sharp intake of breath when a ground ball went through Daniel Murphy. But like I didn't get like glared exactly. at by Pedro Gomez for having done it. It was like,
well, yeah, I've had that experience too, and not for anything I did. And I don't think this is just paranoia on my part. But when I first started covering games, this was in the 90s when the Yankees PR director was Rick Cerrone, not the ex catcher, but the guy with two R's in his Cerrone. And he, like, I could be mischaracterizing him, but I don't think so. Was not the warmest guy, not the friendliest guy. And in fact, at one point, I did go up to him and introduce myself, and he said, "We know who you are," which was sort of ominous and not like, "Hey, great to meet you," which is what a normal person would do. But he would kind of stride up and down the rows of the press box, not talking, just sort of looking down like a hall monitor, or if you were in study hall and, you know, he was trying to see if you were, you know, maybe passing notes to the girl next to you. Like, it always seemed like even if you were very legitimately there, you were on the verge of being asked to leave for some infraction that only he could see.
What a fucking chill vibe to instill in somebody's workplace.
It wasn't comfortable. And again, he was having to deal with George Steinbrenner. So, I mean, maybe.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe he was just passing it down. But
I assume so. But yeah.
So
that's still.
So as somebody who is going to go to Mets games, how do you feel about them as part of this epic winter of rebuilding that they haven't had? Stopping up Dominic Smith with the aged remains of Adrian Gonzalez.
Oh, boy. I mean, you know, in the most basic sense, it doesn't strike me as like a bad deal. You know, like it wasn't that long ago that Gonzalez was a good player. He's like old, but he's not crazy old, and they're not paying anything for him. So it seems like he does not have a fantastic reputation as like a mentor to young players or like a clubhouse presence of any great sunniness. And,
right,
you know, those are obviously both going to be important traits for a team that I guess at this point is, you know, probably not going to contend. But like beyond the merits of the individual move, it just feels like not something that a winning team does. You know what I mean?
It is picking sort of a superannuated veteran who may not have anything left and putting him in the way of a kid who has a lot to offer. At the same time, Smith was pretty bad.
Oh, yeah. Awfully bad.
and maybe less mobile than your average lazy boy recliner at first base. Yeah. So, I mean, it says something when a 36-year-old with a bad back is being considered an upgrade on this kid who is 22. So I feel like that's a vote of no confidence in general, even if they're saying it's not.
It's hard to read it any other way. I mean, I think it's the most charitable reading is that they're trying to get something for nothing, which is, you know, again, if we're going to play the pretending to be the owner's game and like whatever, knowing that Adrian Gonzalez is getting paid anyway, then, you know, sure, like it's worth it. I think that they just need to, you know, see what they see from Smith. And if they really don't think that he's going to be a capable major league player, then that would be a wasted first round pick and something to feel bad about. They've, you know, had a decent number of those. It's just, to me, like if it's the sort of thing that's going to motivate Smith in spring training or whatever, and they've been concerned, that's their concern with him, I think, is that physically he's kind of a soft bodied dude. And is he motivated enough? Is he in good enough shape? Whatever. And if it's the sort of thing where he has to go to spring training and beat out Adrian Gonzalez, then like, that's great. If it's the sort of thing where the job is, you know, belongs to Adrian Gonzalez and they're going to like let Smith hit at elevation in Las Vegas for a year and then have no idea if any of that carries over, like, I don't, who does that benefit? Like, it stops the service clock on a guy that it doesn't seem like they really have a whole lot of faith in one way or the other. This is confusing. If it was a different handed guy, if you wanted to try to platoon it or whatever, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. They've made almost no moves. I mean, like most teams have not. I mean, you can kind of figure out what it is that, like, for instance, the San Francisco Giants are trying to do, you know, and they've made a few trades and stuff like that. But you can see the sort of strategy and the roster that they eventually are going to try to pull together. Even with teams that have guys that they need to trade, like the Phillies, you can sort of see what they're trying to do. With the Mets, it's like there's all these holes. That it's not clear that there's any money to fill any of them. And most of the moves that they've made have been, it's just, there doesn't seem to be any sort of sense of urgency. I don't know if they're just like waiting to see that they can get a bunch of guys on minor league contracts before spring training or whatever. I mean, that's kind of a classic Mets move. It's just weird that, to see them doing that a month before spring training starts and with like Lorenzo Cain unsigned.
Well, right. And Lorenzo Cain, as I've been saying all winter, is kind of the most problematic of the free agents because he's the oldest of the group or one of the oldest of the group. He's like 32. And if you sign that guy to a 3-4-5 year contract, given his injury history and the fact that he's kind of up and down, you might be in trouble. But at the same time,
Carl Crawford type deal. You just get the bad years after all the good ones.
Well, and I think that's a risk with too many of these guys, which is the one kind of legitimate argument about why nobody's clamoring to sign a lot of these guys. But I mean, I'm as big a Brandon Nimmo fan as the next guy, but you'd think that if there is a relatively inexpensive upgrade out there, you might as well go for it.
Yeah, that's been the Nimmo offseason has been defined by the fact that the Mets are apparently unwilling to trade him for Josh Harrison, which is, when you're talking about that as like an important transaction, like congratulations on your fantastic baseball team, obviously. But it's the sort of deal where like Nimmo's main asset to the team seems to be that he's making the rookie minimum. I mean, he doesn't play a position of significant need for them now that they've signed Jay Bruce for their own Metsy reasons. Like, it just seems like, I don't know, all of it is...
Well, who's the center fielder then? Is Juan Lagares the center fielder every day, if not for Brandon Nimmo?
I mean, I sure hope so. Nimmo, whatever. I mean, Nimmo apparently can play center field. This has always been the thing that has been said about him. The times that he's been measured in center field in the majors, he has really not... He's been able to stand out there, but he's not been like... He was like Curtis Granderson-y, you know? Like, he's a terrific athlete. He's a very good defender in left, where they have a guy. And in right, like, I don't know. To me, like, Lagares is a dude that the Mets are not appreciative of enough. I mean, he's not been healthy, but the amount of value that he adds as a defensive player, and also, like, the fact that he's, like, a tweak, it seems, away from being, like, a completely competent, like, you know, whatever, Kevin Pillar-type offensive player. At that point, he's extremely valuable, and he's really not paid very much. But by the Mets standards, the fact that they're paying him, you know, $5 million and that he doesn't hit a bunch of homers, I mean, that's a guy that they're trying to cut bait on this offseason.
Well, the thing is that he was 28 last year, and when you're talking about a guy whose entire game is speed, and he's had some injuries that may or may not be debilitating, like, the shelf life on him is shorter than your average dozen eggs. And so that's the one hesitation I would have in saying, like, yeah, let's see if we get a Kevin Pillar season out of him. Now, I want to hit you with this. You're not going to laugh, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's a very Stephen Goldman thing. But this, I know what Brandon Nimmo's nickname should be. This is the first baseball podcast that's going to make a Windsor McKay reference, which is only about 120 years out of date. But he should be Brandon Nimmo in Slumberland. That,
which is better than, you know, his Twitter handle is You Found Nimmo, like Finding Nemo. So that's how long the distance is between you. That, like, you're going back to the classics, and he's like, when I was a kid, there was a cartoon.
We could go even further back. We could go to Jules Verne. He could be Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
And he could be, I mean, these both work for the Mets, by the way, Slumberland and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh, good. Come on.
Or 20,000 Seas Under the League.
Yeah.
It's either way.
Yeah. It's tough, but they do make for good jokes. That's basically the value that the Mets add for me at this point. I've been having this conversation with some coworkers just in the wake of the Patriots making it to the Super Bowl again, stuff like that. But whether it is actually, in fact, better to cheer for a bad team than a good one, like just better for your soul, but then also just in general, if it's more interesting. And I think broadly that the answer is yes. But I also, there's a different type, you know, there's different types of bad teams. If you want to cheer for like the Brooklyn Nets, where they're like spunky but shitty, and then like on a given night they can like catch the Holy Ghost and beat a good team, that to me is like, I spent most of my life doing that, and that's fine. When you are cheering for a bad team that their every move feels like a metaphor for like the failed state of affairs in our politics and economy, then like it's a little less fun, or at least it's less fun in January. You know, like who's to say that by April I'm not talking myself into Anthony Swarzak as the next Andrew Miller or something.
When you said failed state, I was waiting for Sudan, Rwanda. I didn't.
They don't have the panache. The Wilpons could never pull off the epaulets and the reflective sunglasses. They don't have the any dictatorial flourish. Like all the depressing stuff is there, but thankfully, like less in the way of famine, and sadly, less in the way of sartorial boldness.
Are you at all psyched for the Hall of Fame class that we may get by the time this podcast goes up? The voting results for this year will be announced, and looking at the ballots that have been publicly released, well, we already know via the Veterans Committee, Jack Morris is in, his mustache is in, and Alan Trammell is in. So that's three plaques right there, Morris, the mustache, and Trammell. It also looks like in terms of trends, and about half the ballots have been revealed. So unless the unrevealed ballots, the ballots that have not been disclosed differ dramatically, we could see Vlad Guerrero in, Chipper Jones in, Jim Tomei in, Trevor Hoffman in, Edgar Martinez maybe, maybe not, right at the edge of...
But closer than he's been, right? A lot closer.
Much closer than he's been. And Mike Messina pretty close too. So whether you count the mustache as a separate entry or not, that's up to you. But by my count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 guys are standing there in July at Cooperstown.
I'm into it. I mean, I would love to hear Jim Tomey's speech. I just think of him as being like the version that John Boyce made up in the old dugout things, where he just speaks only in all caps, and he's constantly like, "Hey guys, want a soda?" He's like a big bumpkin who like is full of love and goodwill. I mean, to me, like those guys are all Hall of Famers. Like I'd add Gary Sheffield to it too. Like let's go nuts. Like let's do it. I'm happy anytime there is a large Hall of Fame class, because to me, like the Hall of Fame is the least interesting part of that museum. Just as a general rule, I think the ritual of excluding guys to sort of flex that you have the capacity to exclude them, which certainly has felt the case. I mean, it's the year where they didn't induct anybody. It just seems, and you know, all of this posturing about Clemens and Bonds, I understand the Clemens and Bonds qualms, honestly. Like, I'm not going to pretend that I don't. But also, like, the Hall of Fame exists so you can put players in it. Like, these guys are all, I think, deserving candidates. And when you start getting into, like, how many ballots you have to sit through before you deserve it or whatever, you mostly lose me. Does it seem like too many guys to you? I mean, I feel like you seem as a borderline guy, but I think it will absolutely deserves it. And I think Edgar does, too.
I'm all about the story and less so the stats. And the stats and the story for Messina, the stats actually speak really loudly if you're willing to see that he was pitching in a really high offense era for the Orioles part of it, for a team that didn't always support him. And of course, he was having to pitch against the Yankees and the Red Sox a lot and these very good teams. The story maybe less so because he was kind of a dry guy and not the most media friendly guy. And he just kind of up and walked away. He won his 20 games. He checked that box and he left. But I think objectively he should be in. And I too am for a large haul and for deflating the posturing of these gatekeepers who feel like they're protecting something that's very special that has Pop Haynes in it or has Cap Anson in it or any of those guys. So, I mean, the hypocrisy bugs me. So the more the merrier, because their stance just doesn't make much sense and is not very defensible.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent that you can make it more about baseball and less about the crustaceans that vote on who gets into the Hall of Fame, like anything you can do to militate towards that end, I'm with it. That's it. I mean, it's the whole point of it.
Right. Exactly. And
this is a question I have for you as somebody that knows more about baseball than me. Why is Gary Sheffield not getting any consideration on these ballots? Because he's in like the teens or 20s. And I feel like, I mean, he just had a fantastically long prime at one World Series. I mean, like, did just he change teams too much?
He was implicated in some of the Bond stuff. He was Bond's training partner. If you read the transcript of those trials, it didn't sound like they were doing right, whatever the hell it was they were doing anyway. Bonds was talking about creams and things. He was applying them topically. I don't know that actually functions as a performance-enhancing drug quite the way that say, you know, popping whatever A-Rat gummies there were just a few years ago. So there's that. His personality was not the greatest. He, to me, this is a big deal, right? That he said that, and this is when he was a very young and possibly immature, stupid person, as we all were as young men in our late teens, early 20s, that he wanted to get out of Milwaukee so badly that when he was a third baseman, he was intentionally tanking plays.
Right.
And it seemed very strange to me at that time that a player would disclose that and you would not have the wrath of whoever the commissioner was at that point coming in and suspending him for 50 or 100 or a year or whatever, because that's being one of the Black Sox except without the bribe. You're just doing it on your own. And people made a lot of excuses for that and said he was hyperbolizing and just exaggerating. But I think that kind of thing makes him uncomfortable or makes people uncomfortable with him. And he's one of those players who did move around a lot, I think not just as a reflection of free agency in the era in which he played, but just because people tended to get kind of burned out on having him around.
Yeah, I know he was like a difficult dude and everything. I just didn't realize if it was like the Dick Allen type of difficult where like you're never getting in, or whether it's like the Jim Rice type of difficult where like once everybody sorts their shit out, you get a chance. I think he was a better player than Rice by a lot.
Yeah, he was. He was a tremendous hitter. As an outfielder, his voyages were like Magellan's.
Yes.
He had these weird routes to fly balls that involved kind of circling them and then drawing slowly smaller concentric circles until he and the ball arrived at roughly the same spot. You can't say that.
Look how the New York Times covers a big story. He flooded the zone. He would get as many different angles on a ball as possible, which I respect as a journalist.
Yeah, he got pretty much all of them. And I guess you can't say that he missed too many. It just was a bit harrowing to watch. Yeah. It wasn't as harrowing as watching, say, Bobby Abreu fear the wall, and that if anything was hit over his head, he just wasn't going back for it because, you know, the wall bites. It's red and fang and tooth. And Bobby Abreu is a hell of a hitter too, but he just, that was not in his playbook. Beyond the warning track, here there be snakes.
I mean, you got to respect it. I also don't like snakes. And I don't like running into things at a high rate of speed. But yeah, it's also, I mean, I don't do it because I'm not paid to do it. Like, I do it for the love. And I do it as infrequently as I can. But I don't know. We'll see what happens with Sheffield. I remember him being extremely good when he was with the Yankees. And that was way later in his career than I thought it was. He was in his late mid-30s. And I remember that, like, fan base really embraced him in a way that I thought was kind of touching, because it's like he's of all the unembraceable guys of that era, like he was kind of prickly. And Yankees fans also, you know, sometimes you don't use the Lee part when you're describing them, but also prickly in their way. And yet somehow that was like they had a love match.
He had such a fast bat that in any given plate appearance, he'd be out in front so often. He would pull so many balls out of the stadium, but foul. And I always just thought if there was some special Gary Sheffield button where he could rotate the ballpark just a little bit to the left, that he would hit about 150 home runs a year because he was that quick, even in his old age. And again, it's a shame because he's one of the greatest right-handed hitters of all time. 500 home runs, maybe you can take or leave based on when he played
and everything,
the era and everything. But I mean, he's also a 292 hitter with an on-base percentage pushing 400. So, and like I said, just killed the ball.
Yeah, that was the part of it that always, so, like, and I tend to give sort of special points for this because of how I remember things, you know, that like the hitters that seem really scary, I give like are graded way on a curve. Like Will Clark is not a Hall of Fame hitter, but he was scary as shit. Like when Bonds was like really Bonds, you know, which whatever, you can debate how much of him was actually Bonds at that point and how much of it was, you know, Maybelline, but he was like fucking Darth Vader. He was huge. He's right on top of the plate. You couldn't beat him. Like that was a cool experience. It was an experience outside of a baseball experience. And like Sheffield had that too, that like waggling his bat and the fact that he was so quick to the ball was just kind of like, I don't know. It was a more of a visceral baseball experience than you get from a lot of these guys. Jim Thome doesn't quite deliver that for as many other good traits as he has.
No, I mean, Jim Thome was more of a blunt object. He was the lumberjack who was just going to go up there with a sequoia and kill some things. And it's amazing in retrospect that this was a guy who came up as a third baseman and actually played there for a few years, given that he was kind of a sequoia himself.
Completely rectangular in an admirable way. But I mean, yes, they're like all right angles on that guy.
And just to get back to Bonds, the thing that was amazing, and I don't think you can accord this to any drug, oral, topical, rectal, whatever the hell you want to say, like by the time he got to the peak of what he was doing, he was being walked 200 times a year. He might get one pitch to hit every other plate appearance, and he always hit that pitch.
It's unreal.
And that's the ridiculous part.
That's the part of it that I think is like hard to explain to. I mean, I have like some coworkers that are basically too young to remember really good Bonds, which is incredible. I mean, like they sort of do. They're only in their teens or whatever, like or early teens. But it was that feeling of inevitability, and then also of just knowing how narrow that margin was. The idea of it, like people walking in with the bases loaded, people like, you know, just the deference with which he was treated was insane. The numbers that he put up look, they're not baseball stats. Like on base percentages, they'll start with 7. You know what I mean? Like it just doesn't, or it's like, whatever. Like, that was kind of the fun of it. I was at Cox when he had when he was at his peak and they had an autograph deal with him. And every dealing that people had with him made him sound like they're just one of the most impossible humans that had ever existed. It seems like he's mellowed out a little bit in his retirement. But I also know he's got like a lot of creepy stuff on his docket, just as like as a guy beyond the PED stuff. So I can sort of understand the ambivalence, but I also feel like eventually, just given what he was when he was that great, like you shouldn't have a Hall of Fame if he's not in it. It's just not right.
I mean, if you want to make that case, right, if you're a sports writer and you just want to say, I don't want to vote for him because he was a dick to me and he was a dick to his teammates and was known for being, that's fine, I guess. But on a pure baseball basis, you cannot make it purely on the PED thing because it just doesn't make sense. And
if he'd retired instead of going to the Giants, he'd be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, right. But not even that. I mean, look, we've had a lot of guys caught taking PEDs by now, and none of them turn into Barry Bonds. Yeah. None of them turn into Roger Clemens. So if you want to say, okay, we'll deduct what seems fair at that point. 2% from Barry Bonds, 5%, 10%. Let's deduct 20% from Bonds and Roger Clemens, and we still have guys who are among the greatest players of all time. But I don't think realistically you can take 20%. You can't. Nobody's getting that kind of improvement. Most of the guys who take it because they're not that good. And guess what? They don't get any better because it's not inherently there.
They just get bigger.
Yeah.
That's the part of it that was funny at that time. Everybody got big. All the backup catchers look like fucking Sylvester Stallone. And they still were backup catchers. They just, if they got a hold of the ball, they hit a homer. But that was true, too. It didn't, like, turn Bobby Estalea into, you know, Buster Posey. It turned Bobby Estalea into someone with, like, back acting.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And so there's so much about it, and this brings our conversation here at its end full circle, that people feel qualified to pronounce on and say that they understand with their journalism degree or whatever the heck, that they understand about these complex biological functions and how Barry Bonds got to be Barry Bonds, just as people are willing to defend Bob Nutting and his cost cutting.
It does seem like one of those things where you kind of, I mean, for me, the fun of baseball is the part of it that you don't understand and that you can't predict, right? I mean, it's the stuff that happens sort of at a level that is not, you know, so much analyzed as felt. But I think also, you know, there's such a thing as too much feeling. And I think you have to kind of like check yourself in those sorts of ways, because like, if your real issue is with, you know, whatever baseball players getting paid and you find yourself like emotionally siding with a billionaire who doesn't give a shit about you, then like, you should look at that.
And that is yet another thing we can extrapolate so far outside of baseball that it hurts. It's like,
yes, fantastic.
Prolapsed thinking. It's so
Jeez, yes. Oh, that's good. That's why this is America's Good Time podcast, because we always remember to bring it back to the collapse of everything we ever held dear.
Exactly. God bless. David, thank you very much for coming by again. It's been way too long.
Thank you for having me. I would do it again right now if you wanted.
Don't tempt me.
Thanks, man.
By Flegel's Fleas, we have come to the end of another episode. To follow David Roth on Twitter, go to @David_J_Roth. When you see underscore, read righteous. As for me, you can follow me @GoStephenGoldman. Why go Stephen Goldman? Because go left, Stephen Goldman. Go right, Stephen Goldman. Go north, go south, Stephen Goldman. Life is just full of Backseat Drivers. We have a sponsor now, but nonetheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 17. Our producer is Ursula Twang. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have in fact been hearing throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. I've known Rick since we were 6. We haven't changed at all. Still both dreaming the same dreams. Still both only 3 feet tall. Well, if Marge Schott doesn't emerge from hell to try to sell us all Satan's used Pinto fleet, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.